Of all the things that tend to perplex people about the United States, this country's gun culture is surely near the top of the list. Not many places in the world, and certainly none of the places I lived in before coming here, have such a bizarre relationship with firearms. Not just the ubiquity of them, the ease with which you can get your hands on one, but this idea that having a gun is an expression of some kind of fundamental freedom. To this day, the only time I've ever seen a rifle fired was in Afghanistan, when I was covering the war. And that was during a firefight. The idea that these same tools should be readily available to the vast majority of adults in a country has always struck me as, let's just say, weird. So maybe I'm not particularly qualified to explain American gun culture. But our guest is. On this week's episode, we talk to David Yamani, who teaches sociology at Wake Forest University. His first book about guns, called Concealed Carry Revolution: Liberalizing the Right to Bear Arms in America, was published in 2021. And he's just finished another one called Gun Curious, a liberal professor's surprising journey inside America's gun culture. From his office in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, David told me this is not an easy subject to take on.
Working in this area is so fraught. There's so little trust. And this is obviously a product of our political times. Guns have become a wedge issue in our political system over the past 12 years that I've been doing this work, more than any time in American history.
I'm Omar Lakad, and this is Without. On today's episode, sociologist David Yamani talks to me about the psychological side of gun ownership, and I ask him to imagine what a world without guns might look like.
Politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. And now, here's my conversation with sociologist David Yamani. David, what got you so fascinated with studying guns in America?
Well, you know, I came from completely outside of gun culture in my personal life, growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area and then being part of academia. But when I moved to North Carolina in 2005, over time, it became pretty evident that I was one of the few people in the state who didn't have guns, or at least didn't have any experience with guns. Before I even knew that I was interested in firearms, I was in a hotel room during a rain delay at my son's tennis tournament in Georgia, and I was flipping through the channels, and I came across this show on the History Channel called Top Shot. Basically, it was a survivor-style competition show in which feats of marksmanship were performed on high-speed video.
Red team, we flipped a coin. You guys will be shooting first. Who are you sending to the first station? Gary, gonna take it on the Smith & Wesson, shooting with his pinky. Head on up.
We got this.
Put the pressure on him, Gary. Come on.
Gary went up there and he immediately set the tone. You know, he went 3 for 3, did a great job, and I had to go up there and hit 3 bottles. Picked the gun up, got it comfortably seated in my hand, and then I brought it up to fire, and I knew I'd missed as soon as it went off.
Jake misses on his first shot. All right, red team leads 1-0.
And I had never seen people shooting guns like this before. I just watched episode after episode after episode. And so before I was even really consciously aware that I was interested in guns, which would happen months later, I had this seed planted in me of the kind of normality of firearms and the things that people do with firearms other than kill themselves or kill other people. It seems sort of trivial in a sense, but Top Shot, I know in conversations with a lot of people since then, really affected a lot of people in their views of firearms. It ran for 5 seasons. It's not on the air anymore, which I think is unfortunate because it did expose a side of firearms to people like me who knew nothing about them.
I'm wondering, just sort of anecdotally, What does it look like when you say you moved to North Carolina and realized everybody has guns? Like, what does this look like just in your day-to-day life that you start to come to this realization?
You know, in my everyday life, again, sort of blue bubble liberal living in the San Francisco Bay Area to Berkeley to Wisconsin to Notre Dame to, you know, again, it wasn't until I got to Winston-Salem, North Carolina that I started to see things like billboards advertising gun stores and street signs advertising concealed carry courses. I talked to friends of mine who I played tennis with. They talked about guns they owned for self-defense, for hunting, heirlooms that were passed down through their family, a real estate agent who carried a revolver when she was showing houses by herself. And, you know, these are not my stereotypical gun owners, you know, toothless southern rural people. These were IT professionals, you know, real estate agents, fellow professors. And so that really confronted my understanding, or really my lack of understanding, of how common guns are to a lot of people in this country.
Can you talk me through the experience of firing a gun for the first time at age 42? What is that like for you?
Well, I shot the gun because I had this realization that so many people in North Carolina had guns and I didn't know how they worked and I was afraid of them. So I wanted to know how they worked and how to unload one if I ever came across one, or just to have more familiarity. I went out in someone's backyard and they showed me the basic way to load and hold and aim the gun. And, you know, the first time I shot the gun, the actual moment is a complete blank. You know, I think I was overwhelmed by the moment. You know, if you think about, you know, I have a 34-inch sleeve length, so I'm basically holding something that's going to explode 34 inches in front of my face. You know, this is not something that anybody is born used to, and you have to develop comfort with that. So after that first shot, I was like, okay, that's what that's like. And then I take my second shot, I'm a little bit more composed. And at that point, then I realize I'm not anywhere near hitting the target, but then it becomes a challenge to try to make the hole where I want the hole to be, you know, in much the same way that people shoot darts or throw horseshoes or, you know, any of these other games of precision. So by the end of that, shooting about 50 rounds the first day, I went from just being completely blank in the moment of the first shot to wanting to shoot more, to try to figure out how to make the hole appear where I want it to appear.
If you want to pass on this question, please feel free. But do you own guns now? Is that a part of your life?
Yeah, really from that first moment, my wife and I, we didn't go out and just buy a bunch of pistols, but we got some shotguns because there are some really fun shotgun sports where you shoot at clay targets and you get a lot of instant feedback, and then did get some small caliber pistols. My wife was in the Coast Guard, so she was familiar with firearms, also grew up in the South, so it wasn't as big a deal to her. Now we have a small arsenal of firearms of, you know, all different types, from small caliber pistols, shotguns, and rifles.
I think one of the things that sort of influences my thinking about guns in general is that my very limited experience with them was mostly in the context of war journalism. I was out in Afghanistan, and among the people carrying these things, there was never any veneer of self-defense or I need this to hunt. It was understood that this was the vocabulary of killing and that no one was sort of trying to cast it any other way, which makes perfect sense in a military setting or in a sort of conflict setting. But when you move into this area of research, what is the sort of thesis statement for the necessity of guns in America that you are starting to see, since there are so many of these weapons in this country, more so than almost any other country on earth?
If I can, just to go back to your previous point, I think what you highlight is one of the realities of guns in America, and one of the challenges we face trying to talk about the issue is that you really do have large portions of the population whose fundamental experience of and understanding of guns are profoundly different. Some people really only know guns in their negative manifestation, you know, that someone they know and loved committed suicide or was murdered or murdered somebody or was caught up in basically some of these parts of the United States, which are, I mean, they're not war zones, that would be an exaggeration, but, They're certainly not places of peace. And so that fundamental reality shapes certain parts of our populations, their fundamental understandings, whereas other large parts of the population, you know, understand guns in a completely different context, which are some of those more normal everyday aspects in which people, aren't experiencing directly the negative impacts. But, you know, my basic thesis about guns in the American context is that guns are normal and normal people use guns. That from the very founding of the country, although obviously not on an equal basis across people, but from the very founding of the country, guns were widely owned by civilians for civilian purposes, bracketing all of the debates over the militia and the militia cause in the Second Amendment. We know empirically that guns were commonly owned by people who could legally own guns in the United States from the start. And that tradition of gun ownership has continued through our country's entire history. So, you know, I think that's my fundamental thesis. And then to look at the ways that the meaning and the uses of guns have changed over time against that fundamental reality.
The sort of central conflict, to me anyway, that comes up time and time again, every time I went to cover one of these mass shootings, and I did it quite a bit when I was a U.S. correspondent for a Canadian newspaper, I would inevitably have to watch, usually a Republican politician, but some politician make the case that the solution to this thing that happens so much more often in the United States than almost anywhere else in the world is more guns. Arm the school teachers, more armed guards in schools. This notion that the solution is more of this thing. And then I would look at that fundamental statistic about how much gun ownership there is in this country, how many gun shootings there are in this country, and I would feel like I was losing my mind a little bit. And I'm wondering if you can sort of walk me off that cliff or help me jump off that cliff or any explanation of this cliff, because I keep hearing this notion of the solution to gun violence in America is more guns. And I don't know what to do with that.
Well, I think that one way to think about it is that not to make it an either or proposition, right? So it's not either we have guns and guns are the problem, and therefore if we got rid of the guns, then we wouldn't have any problems. Or, yay, guns, everybody have as many guns as possible. You know, I think what we see is that, again, these two different worlds exist where for the vast majority of guns and gun owners, they're completely unproblematic. And for a very small number of guns and gun owners, they're extremely problematic, right? So it's how do you address the guns and people with guns who are extremely problematic, and at the same time recognize that most guns and gun owners are not. You know, if there are over 400 million guns and probably 80 to 100 million gun owners in the United States, if you divide homicide, suicide, certainly deaths by mass shootings by guns or gun owners, you know, it's a very, very, very small fraction, right? If you compare homicide rates per 100,000 population in the United States to most European countries, the United States looks pretty bad. If you do it for suicide, which is the majority of gun deaths in the United States looks not amazing, but not quite as bad. But if you do those same calculations on a per gun owner or per gun basis, then again, you come to this sort of, I think, alternative realization that, hey, it's not a widespread problem in the sense that a huge number of guns and gun owners are behaving problematically. And so we need to have kind of targeted approaches to figure out how do we intervene in those situations in which the guns and the gun owners become problematic.
Is there a set of regulations that to you seems like the right way to approach this? Is there a jurisdiction somewhere in the United States that's doing this better than others? What does that sort of infrastructure look like in terms of regulation or any other sort of policy?
Yeah, and you know, here I have to admit that most of the time I spend looking at those 99% of gun owners and guns that are not problematic. But I think with that recognition, then I look to those kinds of solutions to, say, suicide, homicide, and mass shootings that don't overly regulate people for whom these things are not a problem. So targeted intervention for suicide would be to do some things that recognize when people shouldn't have access to their firearms, you know, which isn't all the time, but it may come up at certain times. And to make it easier for those people to recognize, hey, maybe I shouldn't have access to my firearm right now, and to make it easier for people to act on that. And these things seem maybe simple and straightforward, but it's actually legally pretty problematic to transfer a firearm to someone. So, you know, I couldn't necessarily say, hey, Omar, I'm not feeling right now. Could you hold my gun, you know, for a few days? Can I legally transfer that gun to you? It depends on a whole bunch of things. So, you know, making those things easier to do legally and practically. And then in terms of homicide, we know that community-based gun violence intervention works extremely well. It's not easy to implement, but where it has been implemented, it works amazing, because so much of the everyday gun violence in the United States is extremely geographically concentrated. And then in terms of mass shootings, policies or programs that intervene before people get to the point where they want to do something horrific, I think that we're making some progress in this area, but a lot of the progress that's made never gets seen, right? Because the mass shooting that doesn't happen doesn't really sort of come to light.
One of the things I have a lot of confusion about is this notion of we are trying to focus on the very small percentage of people for whom the guns can be really, really problematic. A lot of the preventative approaches are almost by necessity looking at people for whom the guns haven't yet become problematic. Once that switch flips, I feel like it's too late to be approaching it in any kind of preventative manner. But I guess what I'm trying to get at is this notion of, if I have a whole bunch of guns, until the moment, if this does happen, until the moment that I do something really awful with them, I am essentially within that very large majority for whom guns aren't problematic at all. And so how do you approach a problem like this where, you know, until that person goes and shoots up a school or something, they fall well within this incredibly protected core, protected legally, protected societally by the founding documents of this nation? How do you intervene in any sense before the moment where they join that small fraternity of people who have done something very awful with a gun?
Well, you know, this is a problem of crime generally in the United States, because we do have robust rights, you know, against illegal search and seizure, rights against self-incrimination. So we have a whole system of justice that's set up to let a guilty person go before it convicts an innocent person. So this definitely shifts the burden in a way that if we had a less just legal system, then it might be easier to intervene on people more quickly. And we live with the consequences of that all the time, even outside of the area of guns. So I'd say that to start. But I also don't buy into this idea that there are certain people who walk around who have guns and wear white hats, and some people walk around with guns and wear black hats, and that it's easy to identify one from the other at all times. So the idea of good guys with guns and bad guys with guns is language that I never use, for the very reason that you say, that at any moment, someone who previously we thought was a good guy with a gun all of a sudden is a bad guy with a gun. I think that it's probably the reality that we don't have any way of 100% ensuring that nobody who is a legal gun owner ever does anything illegal with their gun. In the same way, we can't guarantee any citizen who's law-abiding is law-abiding at all times and for their entire lives. So again, I think it's looking for those clues, looking for the signs and symptoms that indicate a person, you know, maybe moving in a direction that we don't want them to go. And I prefer typically to talk about suicide and homicide and gun injury, because those are far more numerous than mass shootings. But whenever there is a mass shooting, I think we oftentimes find ourselves thinking, why didn't we see the signs that were right there? You know, if we, you know, have a more robust system in which we look out for each other, take care of each other, and also create laws that allow us to take action once we identify someone who shouldn't be armed at a particular time, you know, then we can respect that broad system of rights, which is so fundamental, again, even outside of the area of guns, but also make some inroads.
I'm wondering if you can talk to me a little bit about what gun ownership looks like in America in terms of just demographics. Are there any prevalent trends in terms of age, location, anything that stands out? If you were describing gun ownership in the United States to somebody who'd never heard of the United States.
You know, I think we've had for a long time a statistically average gun owner who was an older, white, southern, rural man, probably Christian, maybe of middling income and education. And that's, you know, still true to some extent. But if we look particularly among new gun owners, and we've had a large number of new gun owners coming into the fold, especially since the COVID-19 pandemic, that face of gun owners is much more diverse. So we see many more women, racial minorities, people who live in urban areas becoming gun owners in recent years. And so the face of gun ownership is shifting in very interesting and significant ways.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, here, you know, I think this kind of goes back to that broader thesis of the normality of guns, but the changing nature of gun culture. You know, since the 1960s, I think the center of gravity of gun culture has really begun to shift away from some of the historic kind of recreational and hunting practices, much more towards self-defense. And as self-defense became the core of gun culture over these past several decades, that really opens up gun culture to a wider population, a more diverse population, since if you're going to go target shooting or hunting or other forms of recreational shooting, those really appeal to certain demographics more than others, particularly people who live in rural areas who have room to do those things, or urban people who like to go to rural areas for sport and vacation. But everybody has at some level a concern for personal protection and self-defense. Some people get dogs. Some people put in security systems. Some people move to gated communities. Some people turn to guns to address that issue of concerns for security.
Are we then talking about the perception for the need for self-defense? My very sort of basic understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that during the time period you described, starting in, say, the 60s, for example, to today, that broadly speaking, crime rates have gone down. If that's the case, at the same time, you have the perception of the need for self-defense moving into this area of guns, as opposed to getting a dog or getting a bigger fence. Is that a matter of perception versus reality, or is my underpinning here just factually incorrect to begin with?
Well, I think we, you know, decades of, you know, behavioral economics and psychology tell us that we are not great at assessing risk or assessing probabilities in any areas of our lives. So we're absolutely talking about perceptions. For some people, those perceptions are more real than others. But certainly there are people who get guns for self-defense who live very safe lives, who have a very low probability of becoming victims of any kind of violence. But the probability is not zero. And I think the other thing to think about is that over this period, violent crime or crime in general has sort of waxed and waned. You know, so it was quite high in the 60s, it drops down, it gets, you know, very high towards the end of the 80s, into the 90s, it drops down, it comes back up. So I can appreciate the argument of people who say, hey, crime is going down, why is everybody getting guns? But they don't also say when crime is going up, hey, crime is going up, so it's okay now for people to get guns, right? The number of people, for example, getting concealed carry permits has been going up fairly linearly, even as crime rates go up and down. There's clearly not a pure correlation between crime goes up, people get concealed carry permits, or people get guns for self-defense. Although we do see certain moments when that becomes more common after mass shootings during the COVID pandemic, which was a period of tremendous social uncertainty and social unrest, and that people thought, well, I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe I should get a gun. And a lot of new gun owners and diverse gun owners did end up doing that.
When we come back, we talk to our guest, David Yamani, about what a world without guns might look like, if such a world is even possible. Stay with us.
Welcome to True Spies. The podcast that takes you deep inside the greatest secret missions of all time.
Suddenly out of the dark, it's appeared Bin Laden.
You'll meet the people who live life undercover. What do they know? What are their skills? And what would you do in their position?
Vengeance felt good. Seeing these people pay for what they'd done felt righteous.
True Spies from Spyscape Studios, wherever you get your podcasts.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, we're taking center stage. Introducing NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of Black-led stories from NPR's podcasts. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to my conversation with David Yamani, who studies American gun culture and teaches sociology at Wake Forest University. I'm curious, if you and I are having this conversation 10, 20 years from now, how confident are you that gun culture in the United States hasn't changed significantly from where we are right now? And if not, which direction do you think it sort of shifts in?
I have a really hard time even adequately explaining the present, much less the future. But I think there are some possible futures. And, you know, one possible future for gun culture is that it becomes increasingly politicized so that, you know, guns become more and more just a symbol of your blueness or redness. I think that would have the effect of driving a lot of the more diverse populations out of gun culture. It'll become seen increasingly as just something that people in red states are part of. You know, another one would be that it just becomes diverse and kind of fragmented, right? So there's no kind of center of gravity of gun culture anymore, but you have some people who are into it for politics, some people are into guns for self-defense, some people are into guns for hunting, and they kind of just exist as silos. And again, there's some aspects of our culture become increasingly fragmented and specialized and almost like lifestyle enclaves. So I think those are two definite futures. I think what the future won't hold, at least in this short run that you're talking about, is that there won't be some gun culture in the United States. You know, it's been around for so long now, it would take some massive upheaval for gun culture to disappear entirely.
I have to ask the question that you've just preempted, just because the name of the show is Without. So feel free to jump off of this one as well. But if hypothetically that were to happen, if there was, for some bizarre reason, overnight, an imposition of really restrictive gun laws, what do you think the United States looks like without guns? In addition to just the obvious, there's fewer guns out there in the country, what are some of the sort of ripple effects of what a United States might look like with, if not no guns, then substantially fewer?
Yeah. And I have to apologize now. I'm not sure how this is going to work, but they just fired up some leaf blowers outside of my office right now. Terrible timing.
It's all good.
I think that there isn't likely to be a future without guns. I'll say that. When we talk about a world without guns, this is something that many gun owners would be perfectly fine with. They would say, if you could create a situation in which I can be completely safe and not have any worries, I'd be happy to give up my recreational firearms in exchange for that and to give up my defensive firearms if my safety can be guaranteed. I think that taking away everybody's guns or having people voluntarily give up their guns doesn't ensure 100% safety. So that becomes a bit of a non-starter. But in a world in which there are no guns, we would want to clarify, are we talking about no guns in civilian hands or no guns in anybody's hands? Because in some of these societies in which there's not widespread civilian gun ownership, the state still retains the monopoly on violence through firearms. And this is something I think that we can think about in the big picture of human history, that human Homo sapiens became the dominant species on the planet in part because we were really good with projectile weaponry, beginning by throwing rocks and then spears and then atlatls, bows and arrows. And in that sense, firearms are just the logical extension of projectile weaponry, which has been hugely important for the human species on the planet for hundreds of thousands of years. So if you take away firearms from the civilian population, you're probably going to still have to have some force monopolized by the state in order to keep peace within the population. And if you look at a society the size and the diversity of the United States, that's going to be extremely hard to accomplish.
Thank you so much, Professor. I've taken up so much of your time, and you've been incredibly patient with me. I've certainly learned a lot. I doubt anything I said has been of any use to you, but I certainly am greatly appreciative of this.
No, I've enjoyed the conversation, and I definitely benefit from thinking through these things. Like I said, I'm super committed to trying to speak to people across these differences. And so whatever happens, you've learned something and I've learned something. And yeah, good luck with your work. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Wake Forest sociologist David Yamani. You can find out more about his work by going to his YouTube channel. It's called Light Over Heat. Without is a production of Hyperobject Industries and Sony Music Entertainment. It's written and hosted by me, Omar Lakad, and it's executive produced by Claire Slaughter and Harry Nelson. This episode is produced by Abby Fentress-Swanson, with editorial support from Kendra Hanna and production support from Zaley Mahone. Our theme music, sound design, and mixing is by Joanna Catcher at Nice Manners. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with more next week.
It's hard to imagine a world without projectile weaponry. If we took away the firearms, then bows and arrows, slings would come back.
Hey, Bob. Yeah.